You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Thursday, July 13th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Michael McCarthy. On dismantling solidarity, capitalist politics, and American pensions since the New Deal. Meanwhile, Republicans and McConnell unveil Republicare 2.0. Department of Justice ignores a court order. CBO says Trump's budget lacks math.
What?
Meanwhile, Trump's lawyers don't trust little Kushner. And they were asked about their drinking problem. Don't know what that was about. Dreamers are in jeopardy. DACA under assault by nearly a dozen Republican-controlled states. And BBC reports the Chinese have successfully teleported something to America's orbit. Meanwhile, Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos is making faked date rape a high priority. And Christopher Wray primed to be the next FBI chief. But the question is he honestly loyal? All no, that like and more.
Loyalty. See what I'm saying?
I don't... I like my loyalty to be honestly loyal.
Not dishonest loyalty. That's what I do. But I want the other kind.
Folks, welcome to the program. I am again at a remote location, but we do have a video today, I believe. Every day I find a new tech difficulty, but then I solve a different problem. So it's a constantly... It's like a moving, it's a constantly moving, shape-shifting, metamorphizing target. Just a couple of reminders. Oh, first off, I should tell you that the Michael Brooks Show, which doesn't exist yet, but is about to exist, is in what we call pre-production, is now up over 205 supporters on Patreon. So head over to patreon.com/, and you can work this out with me, the T Michael M Brooks B Show S. So it's patreon.com/TMBS.
And TMBS. Thanks, everybody.
Trademark BS, if you will, is a good way to remember that.
Just too much of it.
Also, just a reminder, this show relies on your membership to exist and to continue to grow. We're spawning new things all the time. We, our studios and our producers are able to produce more stuff. Not only Michael's show coming out of this office, not this office, that office that he's in right now. But we'll have another show that will be coming out of that office. Not necessarily, you know, just we have different hands in any of these. The Majority Report empire is has broad tentacles. And sometimes those tentacles are scaly and small and like pointy. And sometimes they're bigger and more embracing. But nevertheless,
scaly
they're tentacles.
And small and pointy. Jesus.
Well, I'm just saying there are multiple different types of testicles. That's not a controversial statement.
Multiple kind of what?
Tentacles.
Okay. Yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, It is unnerving. I'm such a creature of habit that when I'm in like a new environment doing this, I get thrown off easily, and I'm not used to different things where they are.
You bored testicles.
All right. We are waiting for, I don't know if, is that me? That can't be me. That has to be you guys, right?
What?
What are we waiting for?
We are waiting for, well, actually, I think it's just been unveiled, the Republican plan. But in the meantime, just to give you a heads up, Rand Paul, and my understanding is, and I have not seen the details of the plan, my understanding is supposedly the conservatives have won over the day, but I'm not convinced about that. The details I'm seeing now are that $70 billion in additional funds would be used to help reduce premiums. Okay, so we talked about this, right? We knew there was a $200 billion slush fund. They're going to help reduce premiums. Now, we don't know how long that's going to be, but they increased the subsidies, essentially. It would convert Medicaid from an open-ended entitlement to a system of fixed payments to states. All right, so this is really important for people to understand, because you hear this a lot. They're turning it into a block grant. Now, as it is now, it is what is known as an economic stabilizer in some respects, right? Sort of like food stamps. Food stamps has a threshold. And if your income drops and your assets drop below a certain threshold, you become eligible for food stamps. So in the event of a major financial crisis, let's say, I know that rarely happens, but it does happen, and more people drop below there, food stamps will automatically expand to help those people. Now, and we see cuts to it, but that's the theory behind it. Medicaid is the same way. If you're eligible for Medicaid, you will get covered and you will get those benefits. However, when they change it to block granting, what they're doing is they're saying to each state, okay, you have a limited amount of funds. Do with it as you may. If you end up having more people living in poverty, more children living in poverty, more elderly going into nursing homes, having spent all their assets because we also are screwing them on the Social Security side and 401ks don't work. In fact, we're going to have an entire interview about it now. But 60% of elderly in nursing homes are being paid for by Medicaid. If you end up having more, this is what the federal government says to the states, if you end up having more people in the future than you have now, who have those needs, you are SOL, crap out of luck, COL. And block granting is a way of basically preventing the program for addressing what's going on for population growth, for any financial hardships that may befell people. It's a way of cutting Medicaid and changing it from what it is fundamentally. A guarantee of some form of ability to pay for some health care. And it would undercut that. There is also, it appears that Ted Cruz's proposal is going to be adopted. And this is Rand Paul showed up on Fox and Friends today. To discuss the details of the bill, but the understand that the Cruz provision, there's another way of saying this. It's called adverse selection. But let's let Rand Paul make his pitch first.
I think we can offer something better than Obamacare. What I've been offering is there's 27 million people that were left behind by Obamacare who have no insurance currently. What I've been offering is a plan that would offer insurance to all of them at a cheaper price. Let every individual in this country, plumbers, pest control, carpenters, welders, let them join together in association so they can get group insurance at a cheaper price. But you have to believe in freedom. You have to believe that leaving people alone, right, that the marketplace will bring the prices down.
Yeah. Okay. So the freedom thing, what the freedom is, it's the freedom. In fact, the consumer freedom option that Ted Cruz allows insurers to sell plans that are compliant with the Affordable Care Act, but then ones that are not compliant with the Affordable Care Act. So in other words, you can sell the cars with all the safety features, but you'll also get the opportunity to sell the car that occasionally blows up when it gets hit from behind. I mean, this is the ultimate libertarian wet dream, right? I mean, this is the caller who called in and said, you know, why shouldn't Ford be able to sell the Pinto that explodes? If they tell people that it'll explode, some people will still want to buy it because it'll be offered at a lower price. And that's basically what they're doing. They're offering the exploding Ford Pintos. But these are all, incidentally, these are all guaranteed to explode if you need them. And what this is known, is adverse selection. Or this is going to create a situation where we have adverse selection. So for people who have reason to believe that, at least in the short term, they're not going to need robust health insurance that actually functions the way it should, they will buy the non-compliant one. For people who have a reason to believe, and maybe they have pre-existing conditions, and maybe they have something that runs in their family, who knows, maybe they're older. Maybe their jobs are more difficult, physically demanding. They will buy the legit health insurance. And what will happen is the risk pool for the legit health insurance will be much riskier for the insurer. And the risk pool, the pool of applicants and the amount of risk in for those in the non-compliant insurance will be a lot less riskier. So that'll be a cheaper plan because they don't have to pay out. And what will happen with the plan where you have people who have a higher risk of getting sick, that will become so incredibly expensive that most people who really need health insurance will not be able to get it. And we will return to the situation that we were before the Affordable Care Act, although probably worse because we're going to see some problems with the employer-based health insurance that nobody seems to be talking about, but need to see the details. So that's what freedom will bring about. It is the freedom of people to be hoodwinked into buying insurance that won't be there when they need it. And it is the freedom for people to say, oh my gosh, the insurance I need is way too expensive for me. At least I have the choice to risk bankrupting my family as opposed to not the choice to bankrupt my family. And that's basically what freedom's going to get us. In the meantime, I mean, there was a time where freedom meant something very different. It was not about your freedom as a consumer or the freedom of a corporation to sell you whatever it wanted under any circumstance, relying on the asymmetry between what you understand about your insurance and what the company who's selling it to you knows about it. And but there was a time where freedom meant things like freedom from want, freedom from monopolies that limit your choices. I mean, freedom of choice is really about a dynamic. You don't have freedom of choice to not buy something if you don't have the money to buy it in the first place. And you don't have freedom of choice to walk away from health insurance that will basically make it impossible for you to do anything else in your life except for work to pay for that health insurance. If your child is born with a pre-existing condition, if your child gets cancer, if your spouse gets cancer, if you get hit by a bus. So freedom means a very narrow thing for these conservatives and libertarians. it remains to be seen how this bill is going to be received. But there is a lot of pressure on Republicans to sign on to this bill. Because the option is to go back to their constituents and say, hey, we couldn't pass the Republicare. So what we're doing now is we are working with the Democrats to shore up Obamacare. I mean, is there anything more treasonous a Republican could say to the Republican base than I am working with Democrats to save Obamacare?
That would be like, I don't know, getting information from a sort of hostile foreign government for a campaign. Oh, wait, nope. Psych.
No, not even.
Not like that
so
at all.
Worse.
That's
Are
totally
you kidding?
Fine.
That's fine.
That's
winning.
That's what you're supposed to do if you're a real man.
That's winning. I mean, honestly, I challenge anybody to come up with anything that would sound more treasonous. And I saw a recent poll, I think, that came out today that said 56% of Republicans want their electeds to negotiate to shore up Obamacare. Or I should say, yeah, I think maybe it was 56%, which I find very hard to believe. But even if that's the case, it's the other 44% who come out and vote. And they're the ones who are going to primary you if you're a Republican. I mean, that's why I think there's just such an enormous amount of pressure to basically these moderates, Dean Heller, the rest of them, they're getting a crap sandwich and they're getting it rammed down their throats, Republican style. That's the way they like it, apparently.
You ready for something to get rammed down your throat, Dean? Ready for this? Open. Well, I hope you have a good gag reflex and jaw flexibility because it's happening.
You're gonna have two. Hold your nose. That makes the taste sound a little bit better. It's gonna be like a lot, like one of those like on Survivor when they used to make them eat the maggots or whatever it was.
On the upside, you're personally going to be leading to a lot of human misery, and most people don't have that much of an impact in their lives. You can look in the mirror and say, hey, there's a family who can't afford their cancer treatment because of something I did.
You're going to be able to look at the 50% bankruptcy rate and say, I built that.
I did something in Washington.
Yeah. Do you want to be the one who prevented just generations of deprivation? Do you really want to be that guy in history? All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, an interview I did, I pre-taped it, what was it, the beginning of the week or the end of last week? Fascinating stuff. The history, you can see the way our society viewed pensions and really interesting history of pensions in this country. And the trajectory is not great, folks. I don't want to be the spoiler alert, but let's take a quick break. When we come back, Michael McCarthy, assistant professor of sociology at Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, on his book, Dismantling Solidarity, Capitalist Politics, American Pensions Since the New Deal. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Michael McCarthy. He is a assistant professor of sociology at Marquette University and author of Dismantling Solidarity, Capitalist Politics, and American Pensions Since the New Deal. Mike, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, let's start with where we are. And your book is largely about how we got to where we are today with our pension system. So let's just start with where we are, which is not a particularly great place relative to I guess, pensions if you're looking at them from the perspective of providing some type of financial security for seniors?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, in terms of where we are, currently about half of all households with folks age 55 or older, basically folks that are getting ready to retire, have basically nothing saved for retirement at all. So about half of the folks that are on their way to retirement currently have nothing saved for retirement. So in terms of where we are, we're kind of facing a bit of a retirement crisis. Folks have Social Security that they can rely on, which most have been paying into throughout their working lives, but that replaces a small percentage of the earnings that they were making during their working lives. Most of that that has to be kind of supplemented with other things. Oftentimes, a private pension plan, if people are lucky enough to have one. Only 40% of workers in the U.S. even have a pension plan at all, or just like personal savings or something. You know, maybe somebody has a rich uncle that gave them something. So there's a real sort of problem currently in the U.S. But this is kind of a problem that's, you know, it's not just U.S. specific. It's more and more countries are coming up against these sort of retirement issues, where people just simply don't have enough saved.
All right. So we have and this is, I mean, let's you start your book essentially from around the New Deal. But let's just remind people prior to the New Deal where we were at. I mean, so, you know, the New Deal was a big leap forward in terms of providing that. But the story seems to be that ever since then, the trajectory of providing some type of financial security and a, you know, just a fairly decent quality of life. We're not talking about jet setting around to Davos, but a fairly decent quality of life in retirement. The trajectory seems to be going in the wrong direction since the New Deal. But just briefly give us a sense of where we were before the New Deal.
Yeah, no problem. I mean, but prior to the New Deal, there were sort of public retirement plans. Most of those plans were at the state level. The New Deal established the federal program, Social Security, the Social Security Act, which includes the retirement program. And there was a number of kind of union-run kind of mutual aid societies that existed prior to the Great Depression. Where sort of people in a community would get together, they'd pool their money, and they would sort of use that for things like insurance, but also for retirement programs. A lot of those went under because of the Great Depression, which was kind of something that caused a greater need for a sort of government intervention. So before the New Deal, there wasn't a robust public program that people could sort of rely on. And what the New Deal sort of, you know, what the New Deal kind of gave us was this kind of moment of hope, this possibility of being free from want, you know, in our old age, which is was Roosevelt's. Roosevelt gave a big speech where he laid out these four freedoms, and one of them was freedom from want. It kind of offered that promise, but really, like you were just saying, since then we've kind of just incrementally moved away from that promise, more and more towards market mechanisms and the market in general for providing retirement, which is very risky, which is oftentimes underperforms government retirement plans. And we're moving towards now that sort of pre-New Deal period, where people are sort of have to sort of come up with the savings on their own, and it largely depends on how well they did in terms of the kinds of jobs they got and how well the market is functioning when they retire.
Right.
I mean, if you look at the 2008 crisis, this is really it shows the kinds of this kind of situation that we're in. Basically, between 2007 2008, stocks plummet about 38%, and that just, you know, devastates retirement savings plans, both in the U.S. but in other countries as well. In the U.S. alone, 401ks and IRAs, individual retirement accounts, lost about $2.4 trillion in savings. And those 401ks they've recovered on average, they've recovered those losses since 2008, right? The stock market has rebounded. But
lost 10 years of projected growth during that time.
Exactly. So there's that's a very important fact. They've lost significant years of growth, which means that people are going to have to work longer to get the amount that they were expecting. And two, actually, that average is pretty misleading, because about 45% of people that are approaching retirement, you know, in that 50 to 60 year old age range, have actually seen further losses in their 401ks since 2008. So there's a lot of our dependence basically on financial markets for retirement savings. It creates a very precarious system for people that are sort of thinking about having a stable life after work, and it puts a lot of risk onto individual workers to sort of to figure that out.
And let me just add one other data point. I mean, we can talk about people who have 401ks that shrunk over the course, obviously because of the volatility of the stock market, but we could add to that that a lot of people had to pull out money out of the 401ks. They lost their jobs, so they don't have the ability to put money in. Plus, on top of that, we also know that 401ks as a sort of broad-based sociological experiment, maybe psychological experiment, people just don't fund them to the extent that they need to be funded to be effective in any way. So they have failed in terms of, from a broad-based perspective, in terms of providing the returns, but they've also failed to be an effective savings mechanism. And so if you have a 401k, which a lot of people don't really have one that's even funded, like you say, it's been performing poorly. All right, so let's go. So since what I found interesting about the first era, I guess, following Social Security, in terms of the relationship between labor and capital, and particularly, in the context of unions versus management, that the union's strength was such that they were almost not weak enough and not strong enough to really have the impact that would be durable in some way, if that makes sense to you. I mean, it's obviously it's your story, but tell what happens after World War II. So we have the New Deal. We have Social Security, which is in many respects, and we've talked about in this program, lacking, particularly if you are a woman or a person of color, or in certain professions and whatnot. And I think around that time, the Wagner-Murray-Dingell bill fails to expand Social Security, both in terms of who it covers and in terms of its benefits. But then what happens when people return from where we're in the post-World War II era?
Yeah, it's kind of a pivotal moment, because everything was really on the table. And you had labor unions at that time, a significant portion of them, especially the unions that were in the CIO, had a very social democratic outlook, and actually strongly preferred more robust public, not just retirement plans, but also public health care. Basically, they were advocating single payer health care at that time. And what happened was that there was a very large push after World War II for collectively bargained private plans. And a number of unions were pushing for these plans, unions like the UAW under Walter Reuther, because they thought it had strategic value to kind of get employers to say, you know what, maybe it's better if we just kind of supported a more robust public plan, because that would kind of equalize the cost of our retirement plans to our competitors in the markets that we're in, right? If everybody got a sort of a base retirement that could sort of provide for a stable life after work, then employers wouldn't have to contribute as much into their own employee sort of retirement plans. So the UAW thought that, you know, employers were going to see this effort to kind of to create these collectively bargained plans, and it would shift them over to sort of being in favor of a more robust Social Security system. And that was just simply not the case. Employers were, I'd say, ideologically opposed to Social Security to such an extent that actually they were willing to incur greater costs in establishing private plans.
Well, I mean, this
is strange.
This is, this is not terribly different from the arguments that we've heard over the past 10 years about expanding health care coverage from the state, right? I mean, I remember
exactly. Maybe
it was 10 years ago, you used to hear all the time, $3,200 of GM's car is because of health care and obligations for health care for their, you know, their former workers or something.
Exactly.
And so there was just such a concern about the New Deal in Social Security that we'd rather just take it on the chin because it's obviously more expensive, right? I mean, for an employer to have to provide pension, even, you know, matching or even if it's, you know, not a one-to-one relationship as to what you would theoretically get, you got to put money into that account.
Yeah, no, that's no doubt about that. I mean, it should definitely be said though that employers, I mean, their strong preference at that time was to have neither. They didn't want expanded Social Security, nor did they want to establish private pension plans for their employees. Like they were, and so when unions made this push after World War II, employers strongly resisted. You had major strikes in auto, in steel, in mining, in a number of other industries. And while those strikes were pushing for higher wages, they were also pushing for fringe benefits.
And you make the argument that the strikes were not, I mean, the narrative that we understand is that the strikes showed the power of unions. However, because of the nature of the era, and I guess the challenge of Truman to what was the term that you used in the book?
Reconversion?
Yes, reconversion. Explain that dynamic because it tells a slightly different story about the relative power between unions and management at that time.
Yeah, I mean it's pretty fascinating because basically what was happening was that policymakers. In the Truman administration, but this was true of Republican policymakers as well. If you look at the congressional debates, policymakers were very concerned about the economy after the war. Like once the war was coming to a close, they were very concerned about capturing those new markets in war-torn Europe and Japan, and also about the state of labor management relations in the U.S. Now, during the war, there was a number of institutions, like the War Labor Board. There was policy, government policy, that was like directly regulating unions and management so that, you know, there was a no-strike pledge that happened during World War II where unions basically said, look, we're going to put aside what we're doing. This is for civic duty. And after the war, that all that ended. And so policymakers were very kind of concerned about trying to manage this shift into a peacetime economy, which was the problem of reconverting back into a peacetime economy. And what Truman tried to do was try to have this big labor management conference right after the war ended to try to get the key unions and key people in business. Organizations like the National Association of Manufacturers, the Chamber of Commerce, and others, to try to sort of work out a plan for labor peace after the war. Now, that ended in a failure, and employers basically refused to budge on a number of issues, one of the key ones being their right to manage the workplace. And after the war, you had this big strike wave. Now, what's interesting about it, like kind of what you were saying when you led into this about labor being too weak – yet, you know, strong but not strong enough. The labor goes on strike, but actually they really weren't in a very strong bargaining position after World War II. One, you had this drastic decline in demand for wartime goods, So most strikes during that strike wave in 45 and 46, employers didn't even run strike breakers. They just let stock and equipment sit idle. And two, you had this big influx of soldiers coming back from the war. So if they wanted to run strike breakers, they could easily. There was a large supply of labor. And so the leverage of unions was actually quite weak. And so,
so we, just to be clear, so we had a lot of scabs if necessary, but at the same time, there was overcapacity to produce that management had, and they were perfectly, you know, that mismatched the demand, I guess, at that point. So they were perfectly happy to basically, we're just going to take a moratorium on our production
exactly.
of whatever we're doing.
And actually, they were saving on labor costs,
right? You know? Right.
So they're not paying their striking workers, and so what happened was there was kind of a standoff over this issue, and it would not have. I don't think that it would have resolved in the favor of labor winning collectively bargained pension plans had it not been for the Truman administration to intervene in these conflicts. And when the Truman administration intervened, it wasn't because they you know, they loved private pensions, or they were somehow sort of, you know, just in the pocket of unions or something like that. It was because policymakers were really concerned about sort of getting the American economy working again and capturing those economic opportunities in European and Asian markets. And so Truman administration intervened in some cases directly seizing production. There was a number of cases where Truman actually comes in and uses the law to kind of force workers back to work, to sort of seize production, threaten to run alternative workers if they don't. And the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, which was Truman appointed at the time, made a number of really key rulings relating to labor law around the legality of bargaining over pensions, which essentially encouraged employers to bargain over these things.
So basically, they weighed in favor of the unions, and they strengthened
yes.
the unions' bargaining in that situation, which was in some ways ironically a ploy to get the management to basically say, hey, we want to just support public expansion of pensions.
Right. I mean, labor wasn't strong enough to win that. And labor was always a, you know, one element of the Democratic Party's constituency, in particular the Northern Democratic Party. The Southern Democrats were all extremely anti-labor.
Right.
And, you know, they didn't have the power within the party or within politics to actually achieve a more robust public program, but they were a significant constituency in Truman's, party. He needed the CIO and the CIO for his reelection campaign, and so that sort of encouraged him and his administration to intervene on their side rather than directly on the side of management.
So
as a result, you get the installment of this massive private plan, which is moving us more towards the market.
But at this point, we should be clear: this is a defined benefit plan, as opposed
exactly.
to what it ultimately turns into, which is a defined contribution plan. So, in other words, there's a certain amount of money you're guaranteed in retirement. And at different times, more or less, has to go into that plan to bring it up to that point. Whereas what mm-hmm. we have today is primarily there's a defined amount you put in, but what you get out, you got to wait and see what happens in the magic black box, essentially.
Exactly.
And so, all right. So the next basically big era is control over this pension money. So we have all this money that's going in that could theoretically be, it's the unions and union members' money that they will receive, whatever, 20 years out, 30 years out, but mm-hmm. they don't have control over it. And so it takes us to the early 70s, when in the years before ERISA, the adoption of ERISA. Explain what ERISA is and explain the implications of unions not having control of this money.
Okay. Yeah, I think this is this is incredibly critical, and it has implications that are so much bigger than retirement, because after the adoption of these defined benefit plans after World War II, these end up being funded plans, meaning that money is put into a fund and that fund accumulates through investing, and that is then drawn on to sort of pay out retirees. And the money in those funds grow, I mean, they grow very rapidly. They go from about having something like $22 billion in 1955 to about $10.8 trillion in 2007, right before the crisis. So these become massive pools of finance, and these pension funds actually drastically change the way Wall Street works. If you were to look at who controls stocks prior to the end of World War II, it was primarily households. It was people like the DuPonts, the Rockefellers. It was individuals and their households that controlled about 93% of the stock market. But that shifts, and by the mid 1970s, you find that about a quarter of the stock market is actually controlled by workers' capital, by these collectively bargained pension funds. And now, if you were to look around the world, the majority of stocks are actually controlled by savings, right, worker savings. So it totally changes the way the stock market kind of works. Now one way of thinking about this is that's great. You know, like they invest in the stock market, they make lots of money. Isn't that good for future retirees? Well, it's a bit more of a complicated story than that, because the way that these funds are invested actually have really hurt workers, both in America and elsewhere. One, these funds, the way they were initially invested was in very safe ways. So they'd invest a lot in bonds, things like that, things that had, you know, on average lower rate of return, but were more reliable. That investment shifts kind of quite drastically towards stocks.
And we should say the reason why that is the case, largely, well, there's multiple reasons, but one is corporations realize and management realizes, like, we can put less in if we predict higher rates of return. So,
exactly.
You know, and that, I mean, to a large extent, that was one of the impetuses of ERISA, was like, wow, we got to make sure that actually these projections on return are not so pie in the sky that they're underfunded, in which, of course, we've seen dramatically, and we've particularly seen it in the public sector.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, of course, the other issue is what these things get invested in. If I can control $1 billion, even if I can't go out and spend it on something that I want to buy a bunch of TVs or something, but if I can control $1 billion, I can shape the future of industries or across industries.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think your point about employer control is really, it's really crucial, because that actually goes all the way back to the Taft-Hartley Act, which was passed in 1947. We oftentimes look at the Taft-Hartley Act and sort of recognize that it's anti-labor in all sorts of different ways. But one of the things that a lot of people don't sort of realize is that Taft-Hartley also regulates pensions and collectively bargained pensions in particular. And what it did was there was a provision in it that made it so these pension boards, the boards that decide where the money is invested and things like that, could not be controlled, could not have majority control by union representatives. Employers could control the whole thing, or they can control the majority, but unions and their representatives could not control the majority of the seats on these pension boards that decide where this is funded. That's that was put in very intentionally because unions, when after these plans got adopted, they wanted to use these funds for more social investing, you know, worker housing, in projects that would benefit the community, things like that. And employers basically are able to take over these pension boards through the law and do exactly with what you just said, you know, say, well, no, we're just chasing returns, which also means chasing risk. And we're going to invest in things that we can sort of say is going to have a higher rate of return. That's going to allow us to put less money into it. But of course that also makes these funds much more volatile and much more dependent on the ups and downs of market swings.
And we should say a projected higher rate of return.
Oh yeah, they consistently underperform, and that's actually one of the problems with it. They underperform, and somewhat ironically, this is the greatest tragedy of the story, is that workers' retirement funds, which everybody at the time has recognized as deferred wages, right? In collective bargaining, they said, okay, instead of higher wages, we want to establish this plan. That this money was actually invested in anti-labor corporations, right? In the firms that were the most profitable, the ones that were getting the biggest returns on their stock, were doing so precisely because they were lowering labor costs, precisely because they were moving operations overseas and into areas that had highly exploited workers, precisely because they were looking for externalities in the environment where they could sort of offset cost onto the environment. It's these firms that have actually benefited and have benefited in the stock market from these funds' investments. And what that does is when you buy a firm's stock, and you allow that stock to increase in value, what you're doing is you're actually helping that firm get access to cheaper credit because banks determine interest rates for firms on the basis of a number of things, one of them being their stock value and how well they're doing in the market. It's a signal to whether they'll be able to pay that loan back. And so it's by funneling money essentially into anti-labor firms, we've given those same firms access to cheaper credit, which has, in the long run, in my opinion, directly contributed to this race to the bottom in working standards, right? Both in the U.S. and elsewhere.
So oddly, the half victory, I guess, the three-quarter victory of unions back in terms of getting those defined benefit. Which started out as defined benefit pension plans, ended up weakening unions broadly across society as those resources were channeled into what ultimately became anti-union forces in many respects. So, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So, all right, we move up through time, and this trend to begin to offset more and more of the risk onto the individual we see this at the during the Reagan era, where the Reagan administration ostensibly makes for a tightening of regulations about pensions to make sure that these companies put in the right amount that would actually end up being the payouts that they claim that they're going to have 20 or 30 years down the road. And in fact, what that does is it sort of gives a backdoor for these corporations to say, hey, you know what? We're not even going to do this defined benefit program anymore. We're going to switch to something called 401ks, which mm-hmm. was just sort of like almost a happenstance.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that.
Exactly. Well, there's one question is why do we get this shift from these defined benefit plans, which we've been talking about, to 401k plans? And it's kind of a fascinating story because what happens is that if there's one theme that kind of runs throughout the book about sort of, you know, the causes of these shifts, it's that policymakers are basically constantly trying to promote capitalist growth and trying to promote sort of profitability in the economy. And what happens in the 1970s is basically an inflation crisis. That we have by March of 1980, inflation rising to over 13%, which is sort of weakening the dollar, which is undermining exchange rates. It's taxing capital stocks. It's it bankrupts the thrift industry, undermines government security, erodes wealth like savings. And Wall Street was basically, very worried about this inflation crisis. And so what happens is policymakers move to try to deal with it. And how they think about it and how they understand where inflation comes from has nothing to do with the sort of Milton Friedman, it's just too much money in circulation type thing, right? That's nobody actually believes that policymakers at the time, and also classical economists that were their advisors, all talked about the inflation crisis as what's called a cost push inflation. That it was actually increased cost of labor that was driving inflation, and policymakers at the Federal Reserve and first in the Carter administration and then in the Reagan administration saw labor costs as being the key drive of this inflation crisis. And so what happens is, this is kind of a side story, but what happens is the Federal Reserve changes monetary policy, and the explicit aim of doing that is actually to weaken unions and to allow and to actually force employers to cut labor costs as a way to lower inflation. What the Reagan administration does with respect to pensions is that it actually increases 1974, you were talking about earlier, we didn't really talk about it, ERISA is passed, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. And what that did was it put down a host of regulations on private pensions, some of which are actually quite good. It also forced pensions to retire in more risky ways, but that's another story. When Reagan comes into office, he says he's going to repeal ERISA. It's going to be part of his deregulation program. But actually what Reagan does is he increases the regulatory scope and the bite of this federal legislation. And he does that precisely because it's those unions that actually had some control over their pension plans. Unions that were like in trucking, the Teamsters, or in different sort of building trades, that had some control over their pension plans, and that economists and policymakers saw as the key drivers of this inflation. And so what Reagan's trying to do is he's actually trying to weaken their ability in a host of areas, including how they manage their pension funds. And so these increased regulations that are happening in the 1980s, which is not usually what we think about in the Reagan administration,
right,
actually increased the cost of operating a defined benefit plan. And that cost falls primarily on employer shoulders. And so by the mid-1980s, employers that want to offer some kind of pension plan to their employees are kind of scrambling for alternatives. And it's in primarily in non-union companies that they sort of discover the 401k option. 401k was something that was kind of intended for upper management types. It was like meant to supplement
right.
A defined benefit. But they discover in it something that is actually not regulated by ERISA at all, and something that doesn't have the sort of costs associated with the paperwork that you have to go through and all that. In managing a defined benefit plan. And so you get this shift that's kind of, in a way, a reaction to Reagan's attempt to weaken labor with regulations.
I imagine it was also fairly opportunistic by Wall Street, which at that time was sort of expanding its retail operation in many respects. And all of a sudden, if they can say, like, oh, we can have an entire business here of no longer sort of these large you know, just you know, pension managers, essentially, we can just open this up to everybody, and there's a lot of fees to be made there.
Oh, big time, big time, big time. Yeah, it's just like you know, the two and 20 fee structure. You know, they're going to which is typically used in mutual funds, where managers essentially are taking as their fee 2% of the total that amount that they're managing, and then 20% of the profit that they make above some certain threshold.
Right.
And you'll hear talk if you read, like, the, you know, the financial journalism that, you know, oh, well, the fee structure is changing and they're, you know, money managers are lowering their fees. But when you look at the fine print, it's like 1.9 and 18 instead of, you know, 2 and 20. So the fee structure isn't all that different now than it was, you know, 10, 20 years ago.
So ultimately, I mean, we've gone through this history now. So ultimately, give us a sense of what it's done, you know, to relative to the first part of your the title of your book, Dismantling Solidarity. And what is... I mean, the remedy to me seems fairly, you know, straightforward. It's not just an expansion of Social Security, which, you know, you make the point on some level is a little bit regressive in terms of creating wealth inequality. Because, of course, if you were wealthier while you were working, you're going to make more in retirement from Social Security relative to the average person, the average fee. I mean, just on Social Security in and of itself. I mean, the bandwidth is, you know, up to about, I guess, $110,000-$120,000 a year now.
Yep.
So, I mean, obviously, I think that the solution to something like this is not just an expansion of Social Security, but also probably having an element that is not a function of how much money you made while you were working, right? Some type of baseline that would be added to Social Security. And I guess there's multiple ways of doing that. But what does it do, just broadly speaking, from a sociological perspective, to solidarity to have this dynamic with pensions?
Well, I think that's a great question. Kind of the core issue of the book is basically looking at how this development in our retirement system is actually, it mirrors this development in a lot of other welfare systems. And actually, what's happened is that we're moving more and more towards a system where people are reliant on the labor market for their security, and we're basically more and more reliant on employer provided programs. And the next step to that, which employers want, is to get rid of those completely and just have it be all about individual thrift and savings. And so the big story is really this massive shift it's about the American welfare state. I mean, if you look at the U.S., where welfare comes from, it comes overwhelmingly from, and when I say welfare, I'm talking about things like access to health care, dental care, eye care, child care, a pension plan, right? It comes primarily from where you work. About 11% of our GDP is spent on these kind of private programs, whereas if you look at the OECD average, it's much lower. It's like 2.5% or something like that. And that's also true of our Social Security system. Like the majority of people's savings comes primarily from their own personal or employer-provided programs, about 45% in the U.S., whereas if you look across the OECD, it's much lower. It's like 20. So what that does is it actually puts a greater reliance on the individual to figure out things for themselves, and it shifts risk. You know, this is kind of the critical thing about solidarity, is that solidarity is something that, you know, we're all in this together. You know, we see that there are risks associated with modern life, and we're going to establish institutions that can mitigate that risk for everybody. But the opposite of that is putting the risk onto the individual to have the individual figure out how they're going to manage that risk. And that's what we're moving towards. We're moving towards a system in which
I mean, we should say we're sort of returning back to that system on some level.
Exactly.
I mean, exactly. It's, we're going back towards the Hunger Games, as it were.
Yeah, and the title of the book is, it can be a little misleading, because it's not like we ever really had solidarity, but we had like this embryo of something in the New Deal. You know, we had this glimmer of hope, and we've kind of basically been moving away from that ever since. And so what that does is, I think I think our aim should be to decouple a person's life, their quality of life in retirement, from how well that person did on the market. And what we're doing is we're basically tying a person's non-working life, the quality of their non-working life, more and more to their conditions of work when they were working.
And we should also say just their ability to, you know, just the luck, the wealth that they already started with, you know, the this stuff ripples 50, 60 years out.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's a critical point, because, you know, I don't want what I'm saying right now to be kind of misconstrued as, oh, well, people make bad decisions.
Right.
Actually, even when sometimes progressives talk about, defined contributions and things, 401ks and things like that, they sort of, we will rely on this idea of financial literacy. Well, people just don't know how to invest. Well, actually, I think it's much deeper than that, because even people that know how to invest, right, they make mistakes. And even when the market is governed by Wall Street elites who are, you know, in the 0.0001% of the income scale, we have massive crises, because all investment is a gamble anyway, right?
Right. I mean, the analogy is, you know, why are we why do we have to all become educated on how to bet on horses? Let's not tie our retirement into the horse races, essentially. And just because we can teach people when they show up at the horse racetrack, you know, the best way to do the trifecta doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to be a successful recipe for everybody walking out of there having won.
Exactly. I think sometimes the rhetoric says, well, where's the money going to come from? You know, how else would we pay for this? Social Security is underfunded. You know, you just mentioned that wage cap, you know, where, you know, the taxable income on Social Security, I think it's around 120 right now. Anything above that's not taxable. There, about 20% of households in the U.S. make more than $120,000 a year. And so that is a possible source of financing.
Well, historically, we would capture 91% or so of income generated through the Social Security tax. 91% of all income generated would be touched in some way by the wage tax. And now it's closer to 85%, 84% because of that income disparity. And that 7%, to make up that 7%, would have the Social Security Trust Fund solvent for, you know, before, you know, long after all of us listening to this and talking about it are dead. And there's a myriad of other ways to expand it, depending on monetary theory, et cetera, et cetera. But the idea is that there needs to be a political will and an understanding that people's lives after they stop working, I mean, not to mention the lives before they stop working, should not be a function of going to the racetrack. It has shown to not work. But Michael McCarthy, the book is Dismantling Solidarity, Capitalist Politics, and the American Pensions Since the New Deal. We will put a link to it at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, folks, we're going to take a break, head into the fun half, wherein we will take your phone calls and your IMs. A reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, you can head over to justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off of your coffee. It's great coffee.
And if you buy your crap from Amazon or Jet.com, do so at our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. I hope people enjoyed that. Anything that gets into Social Security territory, I get very excited about. I think that probably comes across.
Matt was enjoying that so much. He was positively, like, cedarific. It was amazing.
I like the New Deal angle of it. That's interesting to me.
Yes. Matt is sort of New Deal, what you are to Social Security, what I am to obnoxious rap lyrics.
I had to say, the thing that I found really fascinating was the way that when you came out of the war and you needed to basically, you were faced with reconversion, right? Changing our economy, sort of how do you deal with all of this capacity and the relative bargaining strengths between workers and capital, and the idea that the unions were just strong enough to basically set us off on the wrong trajectory. I mean, this is obviously something you can understand in retrospect. Nobody could have ever anticipated it going forward at that point, but they were strong enough to not, to get a pension, but not strong enough to get control of that pension and control those dollars, and not strong enough to, and then you had capital, which was just, you know, you see that same, and I think this came up in the interview, the same dynamic in terms of healthcare. The amount of just sheer paperwork, the busy work, the headaches, the projections, if business in this country was relieved of healthcare as a form of compensation, you know, it would be a huge boon, I think. But, you know, we'll see. The Republicans released their plan today. It is
going in a slightly different direction.
Well, yeah. I mean, the big thing is that comes out of this is that they're going to basically put a couple of Band-Aids on subsidies for people presumably living somewhere between 100% and 400% of poverty. The subsidies will end up being not nearly enough because how they will distort the insurance market by, like we said before, creating adverse selection. They're going to create essentially de facto high-risk, state high-risk pools, which we know from past experience was a dismal failure for the vast majority of people. I mean, and the amount of subsidies they're talking about is not going to go anywhere close enough to providing for that. But it may be enough to convince some of the moderates to sign on to this bill. And then the other thing is while they are slashing Medicaid, they are also retaining the biggest drivers of revenue in the bill in terms of taxes on high income earners. If you are making over $200,000 as an individual, $250,000 as a couple, there's an extra 0.9% of Medicare tax and 2.9% on capital gains above those levels that basically, I think, funds, if I remember correctly, nearly $700 billion in taxes over the course of 10 years. I think they're just going to try and go after those in the next round of tax reform. But
that was what I was going to ask you, is that that's just like a short term, like, sure, this allows us to win the larger battle. Why not? Right.
Yeah. I mean, the only question is that when you go into they have two bills that they have set up for reconciliation, this one and the tax reform bill. The tax reform bill is constrained by the same things this was, which is that if you make any, you cannot add to the deficit, and it's not in aggregate.
At least that's my understanding. So in other words, I think what's going to come back is they've added some subsidies in this bill, and they're going to get it scored by the CBO next week. The Congressional Budget Office is going to basically say how much, you know, how many people are going to lose their health insurance? What are the deficit numbers going to look like? And the deficit numbers are particularly important because this is a reconciliation bill, and according to rules in the Senate, it cannot add to the deficit. And as arcane as that rule is, in my opinion, but nevertheless, that's the rule. And so they're giving away more money in terms of the subsidies, at least short term, but by keeping those taxes in there, which I don't think was in the last version of the bill, I think there's probably going to be a lot more money floating around. So you may see them roll back some of the cuts to Medicaid to make it more palatable to a couple other Republican senators.
Collins.
And then maybe in the tax reform bill, they will simply cut some of those services then, and it'll be less, right? Like, what feels worse? We're going to cut $750 billion worth of Medicaid in the Affordable Care Act bill, and then we're going to have tax reform. Or we're going to cut $400 billion worth of Medicaid today, and that's all you're voting for. And then next time, you're only going to have to vote for $300 billion worth of cuts in Medicaid. You know, I think this is the pace it out. Yeah, I have a feeling that's what's going on. But we'll see if this works. We have more sound when we come back. Donald Trump not only apparently spoke to Reuters yesterday, but gave his first TV interview outside of Fox to the esteemed journalist Pat Robertson, who believes that 9/11 happened because of gay people.
Do it.
Kellyanne Conway was on Hannity last night. What's that? The Pat Robertson?
Yes.
I'll get it. I need to hear his voice before we get in there.
It's a classic. It's
been a long time for me. And Vice President Mike Pence's press secretary went on America's Newsroom. And, I mean, basically, it's weird. Maybe Mike Pence has a little problem, but he's trying to stay far, far away from this. And we have a couple other... this clip, this is one of my favorite clips, where Florida's first African-American elected state attorney gets pulled over by a cop. And the cop was, you know, relatively polite walking up to the car. You don't see all that. But as soon as he gets the the ID and finds out he's pulled over a state attorney and has no reason at all to have pulled over the car except for that she happens to be black, it's pretty funny. All of a sudden, it's Eddie Haskell.
Whoa.
All right. we do this all the time.
I just wanted to pull you over to say that I'm glad you're driving in this neighborhood.
There was a computer glitch, and I've never seen anything like that before. We'll go through it. The ability of people in that situation to be calm and friendly. I'm talking about the state... state attorney, to be calm and somewhat friendly, but just ask the devastating questions. I really enjoy that moment, and we will talk about that when we get back. The number 646-257-3920. We got a lot of callers on the hook, as we say in the biz, and we also got the IM machine up. We'll be right back after this brief playing of a song.
No, 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 and I know nation sad. She said, no, 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 no. Things are looking bad. She said, no, no.